How are we doing for cell phones? Are they silent? A big challenge of the modern age. Krishna consciousness is to, can I leave this like this? It's just so unstable the way it was. It's perched in some odd
way. Put it at this angle then.
What happens when it's at that angle that makes it so much better?
Nothing.
Let it be the way it wants to be.
There you go.
The nature of transcendental sound is that it descends. It's not something that, of course, it comes from our own throats and vocal cords, but the sound descends and then we pick it up. So we're advised to chant what's coming through the line of succession, the line of teachers. And that will help us, that will be the most effective. There's so many names of Krishna, and one can chant any name in any order. But when we receive it in the line of succession, then we're getting the thing as it is. And there may be different lines where different teachers teach different things. But we're coming in the line of Lord Chaitanya, I'm coming in the line of Srila Prabhupada. So they're giving us this Hare Krishna mantra, and everything is there. So it's kind of, so we don't need to improve it, or why should we? What will we gain? It's kind of the real shortcut, if there's a shortcut, or the real fast lane, if there's a fast lane, is to hear with attention and chant with devotion. That will help us.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what other questions we might have.
Mm-hmm. When I'm chanting, I chant like early in the morning, and I do about 8 or 10 rounds,
only
one sitting. Then as if I was meditating on the lotus position with my knees like this, and sometimes I do concentrate like on my vocal cords.
Mm-hmm.
Is coming from, and I still have other thoughts coming in, but you know, the more I concentrate, I get this sensation of, you know, well-being.
Hmm.
But I still have a sense that there's something more. Did that even make sense?
Yeah, there's always something more. The mantra always has more than we realize. Because the mantra is Krishna himself, and Krishna is unlimited. So there's unlimited realization that we can get by chanting the mantra. We never reach the end of it. So, of course, when we meditate on our vocal cords, we realize that they're, you know, kind of rubber bands, little voice box there with rubber bands inside. And it's just sort of a temporary machine.
Mm-hmm. Should I focus on something else? Something other than
the main thing is the vibration of the sound itself. Of course, that's coming from the vocal cords.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is the sound, and you can consider that it's in one sense amazing that this transcendental sound can be generated from these material vocal cords. But again, it's because the sound is descending. And then we're using our bodily apparatus to reproduce that sound or to vibrate that sound. The main thing is the sound.
So should I focus more on the sound?
Sound is the most important thing. The sound is the thing. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah.
else might we have?
Marge, I find that when I'm out in the world, you know, out at work and out in public, you know, dealing with life, you know, a lot of times I just feel a lot of like animosity towards other people. And, you know, it's very, I feel bad asking that question, you know, it's like, it reveals my heart, you know. I just feel like a lot of anger and hate sometimes. And, yeah, I just kind of, I hate feeling that way. And what can I do about that?
The novelist, the writer Jonathan Swift once referred to human beings as the most odious race of pernicious little vermin nature ever suffered to crawl upon the face of the earth. It's sort of not surprising that we might sometimes feel negative feelings, spiteful or hateful or other such feelings toward our fellow human beings. They tend to be obnoxious, self-righteous, low, mean, nasty, and all the other qualities that people could probably rightly ascribe to us. So it's understandable that we may sometimes have these feelings. But Krishna recommends that we should see all the living beings in relationship to him, that we should see them all with equal vision, that we should rise above friends and enemies and those I like and those I don't like. That means remembering Krishna. When we see other living beings in relationship to Krishna, then why should we? It says in the Isha Upanishad, it never hates anyone or any living being, person with that vision. Because he sees that everyone's related to Krishna. So we should try to keep that Krishna consciousness, even though people make it tough for us. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Some water. What else?
I'm going to ask one of the general question. What is Vedanta?
Vedanta? Through Ayurveda.
Yeah, I was healing myself, and the only thing that seemed to work, and this was probably 6 years ago, and I sold my business, got very sick, and Ayurveda came to my rescue.
Okay.
And then I, and that led me into Vedanta, just very superficially, and it seems that the Krishna movement has the deepest connection to it. And I'm just kind of reading superficially, because I don't know much about Krishna movement, but it, I find when I was very sick, I had many visions, many visions, and most of them were related to Hinduism. I've traveled quite a bit. It's hard to say what those visions really were, but as I healed and my body healed, and I was fortunate enough, I had time to study Ayurveda. It was Ayurveda that everything fell into place through Ayurveda. How the body was states of matter and how food related to you. It was just beautiful. I don't know any other way to say it. It was just beautiful. My body healed, and I came back. But it was these visions I've never been able to get rid of. I was just like shown planets and flown around, and it was just almost like a drug experience. And then they went away. When I was very sick, I would have a woman stand over me that was dressed in a Hindu. And so I felt like I had to learn this more. But you know, I'm very intellectual, so I learned things a lot through reading and discussing and talking. But I have done meditation. Simply stilling myself, and, you know, my diet, helping my diet with my body makes a tremendous difference. But I still have that sort of dualism where I get feel better, then I drift away from the Vedanta, right? And then I go back into the sort of normal world, dip back into it, eat poorly, and you know, and then the cycle starts all over again. But what is Vedanta, and what is the Krishna movement's relationship to the bigger body called Vedanta? Because I understand it's around much
Chaitanya.
Yeah, Chaitanya. It was, there was also Vedanta long before.
Long before.
But what is the, I guess the two questions, what is Vedanta generally,
mm-hmm.
and what is Krishna, the Krishna movement's relation?
Connection to that, yeah. The Vedanta, Veda means knowledge, and Anta means the conclusion, the last word. So there's a specific work, a specific piece of writing called Vedanta Sutras. And generally when we speak of Vedanta or Vedanta philosophy, it relates to these Vedanta Sutras. Let me place them for you in the larger picture. We start off with the Vedas, which are a vast collection of writings. In the Vedas, the Upanishads are the like philosophical headlines. And the Upanishads are distilled, well, they're just in two ways, actually. One is the Bhagavad Gita, which is considered the essence of the Upanishads. And the other is in Vedanta Sutras, which are a sort of logical presentation of the Upanishadic conclusions. That they're sutras means that they're very terse.
That's right.
They're really like the first sutra, Atato Brahmajigyasa, is the first of the sutras. Now, therefore, let us inquire about the Supreme, the Absolute. So it's quite terse. You'll notice that right in the beginning it says, therefore. Usually, therefore comes at the end of an argument. And Vedanta is so terse that right in the beginning it says, therefore. And that therefore spawns a large body of commentary. Someone says, therefore means, now that we have this human life where we can inquire, or therefore means now that our material efforts have been frustrated, or many other explanations have been given. Because the Vedanta Sutras pack a lot of meaning into a short space. The Vedanta is also quite difficult. To penetrate the Vedanta Sutras is really we'd call it a slog. Not a slog really, because it's not the breadth of it, but it requires a lot of
it's dense.
It's dense, that's the word. So it requires a lot to penetrate that density. Therefore, the author, Vyasadeva, explained the Vedanta Sutras in his own commentary, Srimad Bhagavatam, or the Bhagavad Purana. And the Bhagavatam makes the message of Vedanta more rich and accessible. So Lord, you're right, that Lord Chaitanya, generally these sannyasis or the those who've renounced the world are supposed to study Vedanta. So Lord Chaitanya was a great scholar, but when he went to Benares, the holy city, he was chanting Hare Krishna and dancing. So this came to the attention of the other sannyasis who were there, who were mostly of the impersonalist school, the school that says ultimately everything is one abstract spiritual substance and all the dualities that we see are products of illusion. There's only one ultimate entity. And we're not different from that one ultimate entity. That's their conclusion. And they saw that Lord Chaitanya, rather than discussing Vedanta, was singing and dancing. So a meeting was arranged, and the head of those sannyasis, Prakashananda, asked Lord Chaitanya that you seem to be a very respectable sannyasi. Why are you singing and dancing with all these sentimental people instead of studying Vedanta philosophy? So you'll come on in. So Lord Chaitanya said that my spiritual master considered me a fool. He told me that you're a fool and you can't study, you're unfit to study Vedanta. You should simply chant this Hare Krishna. So on the orders of my spiritual master, that's what I'm doing. So indirectly, he was saying that people consider themselves great Vedantists, but they're all fools because they're all talking this way, that way, this way, that way, and they don't really get it. So then Prakashananda said, all right, you're chanting, but what's wrong with also studying Vedanta? So then the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained to him Vedanta philosophy in such a way that it was more clear than when Prakashananda had been studying. Lord Chaitanya said that bringing your various interpretations to Vedanta is like bringing a candle to the sun. The sun is self-effulgent, there's no need. So one just has to take the meaning of the sutras as they are. So he presented Vedanta in such a way that Prakashananda could understand that the conclusion of Vedanta is to become Krishna conscious. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Vedaischa sarvair aham eva vedya. Vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. The meaning is, by all the Vedas, it's I'm that to be known. All the Vedas are meant for understanding me. Vedanta krit, I'm the author of the Vedas. And I know the Vedas as they are. So Vedanta, the last word in Vedic knowledge, is Krishna. Because Krishna is Vasudeva, so Krishna is everything. He is the impersonal absolute, he's the form of God within one's heart, and he's ultimately the personality of Godhead. So if one understands Krishna, one understands everything. And therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement is offering the genuine presentation of Vedanta in practical form also. The Vedantists sit and study, and you know the result of their study is more study, and the result of their talk is more talk. But they don't go anywhere. What's the conclusion? But we can merge with you, but it's impractical. If I merge with the absolute, then what? And how is it that everything is one when there are so many varieties? If there are so many varieties, where has the variety come from? The impersonalist philosophy says, well, this variety is all illusion. There's really only the one. And then the answer is, well, if everything's really one, and it's only by illusion that it appears that there are so many varieties, where'd the illusion come from? Because if you have the one and you have illusion, that's not one, that's two.
I hope I've made that argument almost exactly.
Good.
I haven't found the answer, by the way.
Well, the answer is that the one has innumerable energies. The Mayavadis, or the members of the impersonalist school, present that there's just one homogeneous substance without any variety. And the members of the personalist school say there's one, but that one is Krishna, who has innumerable energies. In the Vedas have said, Parashya Shakti Vividaiva Shruyate. The absolute has energies. As the fire has heat and light, so Krishna, or the absolute, has various energies. The energy of spiritual truth, the energy of illusion. And the living beings who are the energy in between those two. So when we accept the absolute in his personal identity, then we can derive all of these varieties. Just as every one of us is a person, from us so many varied things are produced. So from the Supreme Person, infinite variety. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So I guess that would segue into another question,
mm-hmm.
more of a Western question, but how does Krishna consciousness deal with absolute evil? Or does it have an effect on that? I have heard of the Hitler argument. It's kind of a typical argument you have in the West. You know, and I know that's a hard, kind of loaded question, but the Western religions do have a concept of absolute evil.
Yeah.
And that's how they deal with
essentially, it's a theodicy question. How can there be evil if God is absolutely good?
Right.
Yeah. And the answer is that in one sense there is no evil, because everything serves Krishna's purposes. But it's evil for us. The example can be given that prison is awful. But it's awful for the prisoners. For the government, prison is fine. It serves a purpose. So the difficulties of this world are there, in one sense because they're necessary. Krishna says, all right, if you want to break the laws, then here's the prison. In another sense, they're our creation, because just as the prison is the creation of the prisoners, really, they're the ones who've made the prison necessary. Otherwise, there'd be no need. So we create illusion, ignorance, suffering, evil, when we turn away from Krishna. The Krishna is like the sun, and illusion and all the evils that go with it are like shadow. The sun produces shadow also, but we don't have to be in the shadow. We can be in the sun. Excuse me?
That's the path I've chosen.
Good, yes.
It's an argument I've had made against me by Christians when I talk about Vedanta and things like that, and a little bit that I know about it.
Yes, any philosophy should be able to explain where evil comes from or why evil exists. Explaining it in terms of some competitor to God, it is not our approach. And I leave it to those who have that view to explain how that works.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Yeah.
Can you tell me what the word Upanishads means?
Yeah, Upanishads. Give a Sanskrit meaning. Sitting close by, yeah?
Yes. Sit and listen, draw an eye unto greatness. Is that close? Sit and listen?
It means sitting close for hearing. That's the Sanskrit derivation. Really what they are, they're like the headlines of the Vedas. The Vedas, as I mentioned, are these vast texts with all sorts of things in them, ritual, chants and sacrifices and a lot of stuff. But the Upanishads, of which there are 108, are the philosophical headlines of the Vedas. Or you can say they're, from that point of view, the most important portions of the Vedas, these 108 Upanishads. So again, these The essence of these Upanishads is found in the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, the Bhagavad Gita is sometimes called Gita Upanishad. Gita Upanishad. If you, when you study the Bhagavad Gita, then you study the essential meaning of all the Upanishads. We've published one of the Upanishads, Isho Upanishad. That's available here. Is that okay?
Yeah, and they're considered
10
major?
Yes, sometimes the 10 are picked out as being major Upanishads.
Has all of the Veda been published in English?
That's a good question.
I understand there's a guy at the University of North Carolina that's done something about Krishna, a professor of
religion. Yeah, Vedas in English. I don't really know. If someone's done it, it's, I don't know. I just never took an interest. It's all this vast, vast stuff to go through. And I'm sure if they've translated it, if a scholar has translated it with all sorts of apparatus and usually when, well, I don't want to say that. I don't want to criticize, but you read through however many volumes it's taken for them to translate the Vedas, if they've done it. And at the end of reading those 742 volumes, or however many it is, what do you know? Right? What conclusion do you have? Well, that was a very interesting translation, and now I wonder what Professor Cunningham has said about that. You start reading it. You can spend your whole life, as there many scholars do, or some scholars do, going through the Vedas and talking about this section and that section and writing dissertations and conference papers and so on.
Are they all written in Sanskrit?
Yes, the Vedas are all in Sanskrit.
10 times more difficult than Bhagavad Gita Sanskrit.
Yeah, the Sanskrit itself is difficult Sanskrit, and the just to make your way through this. In fact, it's said that the Vedas in the Bhagavad Gita, the comparison is that the world is like a banyan tree, with its roots up and its branches down, and the leaves are the hymns, the mantras of the Vedas. And it's more or less endless. You know, banyan tree, there's one in Calcutta in the Botanical Garden that's like a forest in itself, just one tree. Because they throw their roots down and then the roots become more branches and more trunks, and from those branches more roots go down, and the whole thing becomes like a forest, and it's really just one tree, but it's going this way and that way. So the Bhagavad Gita compares the material world to an upside-down banyan tree. That means it's a reflection of the spiritual world. And the Vedic hymns, you can get lost in. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nistrigunya Bhavarjan. The Vedas deal with so many topics concerning this world. There are topics for people who are in passion, for people who are in ignorance, for people who are in goodness. There are so many desires. This desire can be fulfilled this way, that desire can be fulfilled that way. It's such a vast ocean that Krishna says, just rise above all of this. Rise above all of this. Trigunya Vishaya Veda. Trigunya means the Vedas are mostly concerned with topics concerning these three qualities. So, Nistrigunya, rise above those qualities and be transcendentally situated. Well, that's where Bhagavad Gita is directing us. So in one sense, we save ourselves so much trouble. We're not going to plow through the Vedas and this sacrifice and that sacrifice and this mantra and that incantation. We'll just chant Hare Krishna, read Bhagavad Gita, and come to the conclusion. Because this life is short. And our ability to go through all of this is limited. So we can't spare the time to immerse ourselves in all these varied literatures and the commentaries to them. Because
so the path I came to through Hare Krishna, I've lived in Dallas all my life, I've been aware of the temple, but after I got sick, I read a lot of David Frawley and a lot of on the internet, you know, just gobs and gobs of stuff, and had the time to do it for several years. And it all kind of came back here because what was missing was the mystical aspect, the mystery and the sense of infinity that Hare Krishna had. You know, it wasn't an intellectual process I was going through. And Hare Krishna seemed to, the music and the food, you know, and the community just seemed to be more consistent, I guess, to where I was, or just more in tune with what I was reading about intellectually.
Yeah, you get both things. We have intellectual substance, you know, we have so many books, but it's not just, well, come and sit and read with us. We have practical experience or access to direct experience through chanting, through food, through culture. And there's practical activity. Again, when I reach a conclusion of monism or absolute oneness, then what do I do? No difference between doing one thing and doing another thing or doing nothing, because everything is one. But in Krishna consciousness, there's practical activity in relationship to Krishna. So it's so it all works together. As you say, it's consistent.
Some people think you're crazy if you chant Hare Krishna all the time.
Prabhupada wrote a little pamphlet early on in the 1960s, Who is Crazy?
Yeah.
The essence of it was, they think we're crazy and we think they're crazy. To dedicate ourselves to something that will be finished is not a sane man's policy. They're dedicated. Even simple things. People work hard and spend their money on tobacco. People work hard and then go on vacation for a weekend and, you know, get drunk and gamble and do this and that. And then they're back to where they started from. How sane is that? But, or people are identifying themselves with the body, which is not the self. I'm thinking I'm American, I'm Indian, I'm white, I'm black, I'm young, I'm old, I'm thin, I'm fat. But if I'm not this body, then all of this talk of young or old or white or black or thin or fat, these are the ravings of a madman. Just if I said I was Napoleon, you'd lock me up. You know, if I really went on and on about it, and I'm really Napoleon Bonaparte, you'd call 911 or something, and someone would help me.
You'd start a website.
Yeah, I'd start a website, right? That's what happens now.
Nothing to give people to know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, physics, classic, I have a training in mathematics, and physics basically, everything is changing, and then the big question of physics is particle versus wave. Mathematically, how you express it.
Yeah.
It was a profound moment for me when I was healing, and I knew this intellectually, but I realized it in my body, is that everything is in a process of change. And so and that's consistent with modern physics. That isn't something, there's no conflict here with Eastern.
Yeah, I have a godbrother, Sadaputta Das, he's written a lot of stuff, actually, all of which you might be interested in. There's especially one book called Mechanistic and Non-Mechanistic Science.
Yes, I've got the book.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It's a black cover.
Black cover with...
I've read it.
Oh.
Yeah, cover.
How did...
But when I first started, I read that book.
How did you find it?
It was interesting. It was interesting. There was a number of books he's written.
Yeah.
Just that one, but there was some. There was one. Was he the one that wrote the one on archaeology?
Yes.
Also, yeah. The one on archaeology that I remember.
From in there.
Yeah. My first criticism of the mechanistic and non-mechanistic is it's a non-statement. But when I first picked the book up, I thought that because it's like saying non-elephant animals or something. It doesn't really have any meaning.
Right.
In and of itself. And so I was a little negative on the book, but I was reading it, I believe, because there was a passage on astrology.
Hmm.
I think in the book, in astronomy, the relationship. And I think that was what got my, attracted my attention to it.
And he's written another work completely about Vedic astronomy and cosmology.
Yeah, I vaguely remember seeing it. I don't think I've bought it. I think I've seen it in the store. Or
quite an interesting
book. Seen it somewhere. That, yeah, some of that's then stuff. He's the one who's the, he's the one I was thinking, no, okay, I'm thinking of somebody else, I'm sorry. He's a college professor, I believe, or what?
No, he was a mathematician, but not a professor.
Not a professor, okay, I was thinking for some reason. And that was a while ago when I read it, and I didn't quite appreciate it as much. I probably go back and read it again.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the statement about the title. Wouldn't it just come into question how we define science?
Well, that of course, is what's going on there. The assumption is that science must be mechanistic, must be reductionistic, must bring everything down to the interactions of physical entities with nothing more than that. And when we say non-mechanistic science, we challenge that assumption. We ask, must science deal exclusively with physical entities and their interactions, or can it go beyond, can it ask questions beyond that? Or really it says, we are asking those questions or we are making assumptions when we say there's nothing beyond
our senses, for example, you hear that in science.
Nothing beyond our senses, nothing beyond physical interactions. We are making a statement about what's beyond our...
Yeah,
that's well said. Yeah, we're sort of implicitly, what's the word? Well, we're already tilting the argument by saying, you know, science means mechanistic, but it doesn't have to.
No, if you look at science historically,
exactly.
I'm a mathematician by training.
Oh, okay.
Minor in math, but I always study physics and science, you study math, but mathematics is more of the mystical side of science.
Mm.
Now, not all mathematicians say that, but I'm just saying it tends
mm-hmm.
to be. You deal with notions of infinity.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who are mathematicians don't buy into science's theory of everything argument. Mathematicians will say there are linguistic limitations to what we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
How we use language limits what we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And so the classical science doesn't always appreciate. There's a story that physics is telling people. It's a story.
It's a story.
Yeah, it's just a story, and it stumbles and it gets inconsistencies. But it's a story. Great scientists have been mystics.
Absolutely.
Like, you look at it historically.
Most of the best.
Yeah, people that don't sit at a university and depend on it. And a lot of science has been done outside of what we would call a university. And
yes.
It's actually going on now.
Mm-hmm.
Companies like Intel, for example, IBM, do sponsor a lot of research and do a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
And that's historically the way it actually evolved.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have university structures 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to get grant money and all that kind of
stuff? Yeah, right.
You have people that are infinitely wealthy and just were interested in learning about
mm-hmm.
the world. And
how something worked, sure.
Yeah, how something worked.
We have another member of our movement who's doing work in quantum physics and quantum mechanics, he's involved with an institution. We have an institute in Bombay, Bhaktivedanta Institute, which is one of the few institutions where there's a program in consciousness studies at a postgraduate level. So he's in charge of that. What's of interest is that he's taken concepts from Srimad Bhagavatam. And rather, there's sort of the usual drill is to say, well, quantum physics shows us that there must be this other thing called consciousness, and it's a very spooky thing, and we have to look into that. And he's taken sort of a different route, and he's said, what can the Vedic literature tell us about matter? Rather than going in this other direction, what can it tell us about matter? And he's addressed particular questions, the collapse of the wave function especially, in the light of a Vedic perspective. He's got interesting things to say. Not being a mathematician. He also has a gift. He can explain any difficult concept by reference to a more difficult concept.
That's an old trick in software, by the way. Dereference. A little weird.
So there's only so far I can go on that route, but you might find it a topic of interest. He's published some papers on the subject, Ravi Goldwater. Who else has a question about physics? Or anything else? Mm-hmm.
Can you recommend, I know that you probably refer to the history of Prabhupada's books, which is wonderful. Is this such thing as a bona fide translation of some of the major Upanishads? Because I had...
But translation of what?
The Upanishads, maybe the 10 majors. I had the Swami Nithyananda's, which I thought was pretty wonderful.
Yeah. I haven't read his work. He's a known person of the monistic school. Of course, Ishopanishad is there. There are Vaishnava commentaries on the Upanishads, and they're referenced, but I'm not sure if they're in English or not. They're mentioned in Brihad Bhagavatamrita in the bibliography. We'd have to look. There's a book, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. We'd have to look in the bibliography and see if those books are in English or in Sanskrit. I'm not quite sure. They may be Sanskrit. Otherwise, I have no particular edition to recommend to you.
They're probably Sanskrit because Gopi Purnadampur wouldn't want to reference somebody else's translation of something like that.
No, he's referenced stuff.
English translation.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. They probably.
Puridas's
stuff, which would be in Sanskrit, I think. Puridas Mahashaya. It would be Sanskrit, I think. No, I don't have anything to recommend to you.
Are you fluent in Sanskrit?
No. He's better at it than I am. I can get by with a little bit of, I can read the Devanagari and I can familiar with a lot of words from having read a lot of books over the years, but I'm not fluent or even a beginner in Sanskrit, really. He's studied Sanskrit, not here. Just look at him. Doesn't he look like a Sanskrit scholar? And we do have a Sanskrit school in Vrindavan, with students who are fluent and are doing translation work.
Because I understand Sanskrit has an element where the relationship between the sound and the vibration in your body
mm-hmm.
is more than just communication.
Mm-hmm.
The sounds of the vowels of the letters
mm-hmm.
are waking up parts of your body, waking up parts of your being that are different than typical.
There's a whole science of sound. They used to be able to launch weapons with sound. Not, a mechanical weapon, but the weapon itself would be essentially generated by sound. There were other things there's so many things actually that the Vedic sages could do just by sound. So even in our sort of mundane experience, you know, an opera singer hits a note and a glass breaks. So the sound has an effect. And then we get ultrasound and so on, breaking up kidney stones. So sound does things, sure. And the Vedic sounds are highly evolved. But the most important application of Vedic sound is the achievement of liberation. The other things are, in one sense, small accomplishments, to be able to launch a nuclear weapon or to be able to create planets or do all the other things that could actually be done by sound, is small potatoes compared to getting freedom from material existence. And it's said, anuvritti shabdat, by the Vedic sound one can become liberated. Or by the sound of this mahamantra one can become liberated. So this, it's the most essential sound is found in this mahamantra. It's said that all the Vedic mantras and understandings have been compressed into these eight words, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Mm-hmm. 16 words, Hare Ram, Hare Ram. Something else. Hmm?
Could you lead us through some of that sound?
Yeah, give it a shot. Krishna, 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 Krishna.
You're much more expert than that.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama.